a great documentary
makes us question everything. The things that we know and the things we think we know.
But we're actually completely wrong about.
This is the beginning of my last act. In order to know how to go forward, I'm going to have to know where I've been.
The public figures we love.
And love to hate.
The issues that we must face as a society.
Huge cultural moments.
I mean, as a black man, you're born into this world with PTSD.
Things you can't unsee.
The aftermath is worse than the actual levees breaking.
Someone who's different from us, but also
not that different from us.
Somebody offers you $1 million, you're going to take it.
Documentaries show us the worst
and the best
of what human beings are capable of.
I don't know where any of us would be without all those performances on that stage. It's the beginning of all of it.
Welcome to HBO Docs Club, where we dive deep into the true stories that captivate our imaginations. I'm Brittany Luce, longtime documentary super fan, freelance journalist, and cultural critic. You may know me from my other podcasts, For Colored Nerds and The Nod.
And I'm Ronald Young Jr., audio producer and live storyteller, film critic, and cultural commentator. You might have heard me on the podcast Solvable and NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour. During each episode, we'll take a closer look at a film or series in the HBO documentary films catalog. Sometimes they'll be from our recent past, other times they'll be brand new, but they'll all inevitably teach us something about the human condition.
So this week we have the Emmy Award-winning documentary, The Apollo. This doc chronicles the unique history of Harlem's Apollo Theater and its enduring legacy today.
This is 30 years of signatures of all the stars that performed there. We have Snoop Dogg, there's John Legend, there's Beyonce, there's Prince, Whoopi Goldberg, Stevie Wonder. Then over here we have Barack Obama, Michelle Obama.
On this episode, we sit down with two creative collaborators, Roger Ross Williams, the director of the Apollo documentary, and Camila Forbes, the Apollo Theater's creative head.
And they said, you're going to sit and meet with this filmmaker, Roger Ross Williams. Right?
That's right. Right. I was there on your first day. We went to lunch. We went to lunch at Red Rooster.
We went to Red Rooster.
On your first day.
And you were like, tell me about the Apollo. And I was like, you tell me about the Apollo. I just got here.
And as a heads up, this is your spoiler alert. So if you haven't watched the movie yet, we suggest you pause this and come back later.
All right, Brittany, I am very excited about today because this is one of our more happy documentaries. There's a lot of joy in today's documentary, and it features something that I think that you're pretty much an expert on, according to your body of work. We're talking about a large, significant portion of Black culture, which I hear you're a huge fan of.
I'm a bit of a fan. I would consider myself a connoisseur. I was so glad that we had the opportunity to add this documentary to the queue.
I was so glad.
It's so joyful. It's so much fun to watch.
Okay, so let's kick things off with our recap of the doc. Hit it, Brittany.
Yes. Okay, so this film was directed by Academy Award-winning director Roger Ross Williams. It tells the story and the impact of the Apollo Theater in Harlem, which is in Manhattan, New York City. And the doc is so much fun to watch. Like, it uses all of this archival footage and behind the scenes footage with like the different production teams at the Apollo who are trying to put together, you know, everything from a live theater performance to amateur night. And it also features interviews with artists like Patti LaBelle, Pharrell Williams, Smokey Robinson, Aretha Franklin, Jamie Foxx, and so many more.
And so the documentary starts with this new production of Ta-Nehisi Coates' Between the World and Me. It's a stage adaptation they're performing. And through that, they piece together all these other stories of Black performers and Black artistry. And it dives into the importance of the Apollo for Black folks specifically. And it sets all these performances on the stage against the struggle of Black folks in the U.S. So we're talking civil rights and segregation. The documentary is talking about what that looks like in terms of the impact on their performance opportunities. This all runs parallel to the actual performances themselves, and it sets the standard for Black achievement.
I mean, and talking about Black achievement, I mean, The Apollo was a launch pad of talent for Black artists, and the documentary makes that so clear. It was really a rite of passage for Black entertainers to be able to perform there. I mean, we're talking from early jazz stars like Louis Armstrong to contemporary artists like, you know, Lauryn Hill. What the documentary really does at its heart is it shows the journey of the Apollo Theater as not just a performance space, but also as like a real barometer for like Black art and culture and access in the United States. It's like, you know, you could take our temperature basically to a certain degree by, you know, what's happening or who's come through the Apollo Theater. And the documentary really captures how beautiful and affirming and how much fun a lot of that really is.
Yes.
It was like a love letter to the Apollo, really. Also, like a trip down memory lane. Honestly, I had so many positive memories attached to so many of the artists and cultural moments that they touched on.
Yeah.
What stood out to me is that a documentary about a theater, like a building, you know what I mean, was so compelling. I mean, it's hard to remember, I think, at times, especially people our age who grew up with the Apollo. You know what I'm saying? The Apollo is a complete sentence.
Correct.
Like, it's already a cultural institution by the time we were growing up, but it's really just a theater, technically on the Chitlin Circuit, right? So 70, 85 years ago, not thought of in the same way that people would think about, you know, a theater on Broadway or something like that. And this theater and the people that played on its stage really shaped the cultural tastes of America for generations.
Yes.
A performance at the Apollo could make or break your career. In some ways, it served as like a finishing school for, you know, some of the most talented Black creators of all time.
Yeah.
Not even our time, not only our time or our parents' time, like of all time, like nationally and internationally. You're seeing Gladys Knight and Patti LaBelle basically saying that like the Apollo was what gave them their musical education.
Yeah.
It was so interesting when they would explain sort of like so much of like the backstage stuff, how there were dressing rooms on all eight floors of the building. And basically when you were sort of on the lowest rung, you had the highest floor for a dressing room. And you would slowly hope every time you returned to work your way down to sort of like the first floor so you could be the closest to the stage. You know, seeing other artists talk about how after they'd finished their performances, they wanted to change or not change at all,
yes.
right? But just like quickly be able to get down, watch yes. the next act to see what were they doing? Could I put that in my act? Like what's out there? Well, who's my competition? Or even just like learning, you know? Like people would play cards together, ask to hang out. Like all of that backstage stuff. These stories are fun for us to hear about, but they sort of add to this like, you know, quilt of lore. It just was such an important educational touchstone.
Agreed. And I think one of my favorite parts is an anecdote about a performance from Smokey Robinson, who mentions that he and his band didn't have any sheet music for the music they were going to perform at the Apollo. And so he jumps on the piano and he starts showing the band how to play his songs. And along comes Ray Charles.
He said, do any of you know how to play your songs? So I knew how to play them on the piano. So he had me to come sit down. I was a nervous wreck. And when he heard me play one time, he took it over. Okay, saxophones, you write down, blah, 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 right here. And trumpet, shoot up, man, and put that on there. Just did a whole arrangement to both of our songs right off the top of his head that morning.
That's one of the best parts about this documentary. All these folks coming together to tell these little stories.
Totally.
A lot of these huge artists that we know, world-changing artists, we're talking Gladys Knight, Lauryn Hill, Richard Pryor, these are huge names. Mm. A lot of them on their way up, when they get to the Apollo, they become just average. You're just one of many talented people that are just marching through the Apollo. Like the people who were the best, they always shine through, even if they had a tough night. Like Lauryn Hill, for example, she had a tough night.
Oh my gosh.
I treat you bad.
Performed on amateur night and you survived, even if you didn't win, that was an accomplishment.
But then later returns with the Fugees and everyone's like, oh man, like Lauryn Hill's killing it.
If you're misogynist, then you probably cannot get with this. If you sip with this, we'll leave no witnesses. See, nobody can touch what y'all bless, and I mean what? This. So I'll be like Osiris, ready to get the mysis. If you're talking females, sustain it up
the night. The other part that stands out to me is how the Apollo is growing and changing with the backdrop of civil rights and segregation going on in the background. You talk about the theater being on the Chitlin circuit. And I think that was important because there's this one portion where Patti LaBelle talks about being on the road as a young performer. Sometimes you had to sleep in your car. They had to get ushered in the back. Mm-hmm. They couldn't even eat or drink in the places in which they were performing.
As a Black woman performing, traveling around the country and all that jazz, it was hard as heck. We would have to, of course, not go to the restaurants, not use the bathrooms, not stay in the hotels. We slept sometimes in the station wagon. I know I was singing better than any of those white girls who were staying in the real hotels, going to the restaurants, and getting paid much, much more than we were. Not because we weren't worth it, but we weren't allowed to be worth it.
And they say, but then you come back to the Apollo and they're welcoming you there with open arms. And the Apollo documentary does a very good job of saying like, hey, at this time, if you wanted to be somebody, you had to be on this stage. Mm. I think one of the earliest ways they do this is they talk about how artists, they weren't just performing there, but they were being tracked in some ways, even getting into the business side with the owner, Frank Schiffman.
Yes, Frank Schiffman and his infamous note cards.
Right? Frank Schiffman is out here keeping cards on each one of the performers.
Ronald, I want you to listen to some of these quotes, okay? This is from Schiffman's card on the actress and singer, the legendary Pearl Bailey. Her third Apollo performance was on August 30th, 1950. And Schiffman says, excellent comedy, talk, patter, and dance. Temperamental in demands, but a fine performer. Not yet a big drawing card.
Like, I don't, who is this guy?
I mean, to me, it's a little bit of backseat driving, but yeah. I'm going to give you this next one. Okay. Fast forward 15 years later to the last performance by Pearl Bailey at the Apollo. Okay. And this card is from October 22nd, 1965. Schiffman says, the absolute mistress of comedy and song has audience in her hands from start to finish. Excellent. With not one, okay, not two, but three exclamation points.
It bothers me so much that this dude has so much power just jotting down notes observationally. You know, this is essentially what we do today on YouTube in the comments section. You know, like, oh, this person's kind of whack. Oh, I don't really like them. But imagine that comment having all of the power of entertainment at the time. That's wild to me.
Sometimes when I feel like he's sharing some of his more coarse comments, it kind of feels like, you know, shouting from outside the club.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Yes.
But, I mean, it is nice to read the enthusiasm.
Yeah.
When he does have it there.
It's good to see that grow and that he promotes a little bit when they grow.
Yeah. But I would love to know more about what people really thought about having this white man who probably could not even know the upside of a tap shoe, right?
Correct.
Telling them whether or not they had talent, whether or not they could come back. Now, I do understand the purposes of keeping records like that. He also wanted to keep track of like how good was business that night? What were your numbers like? But the few times that those notes were brought up by artists, there's this moment where Dionne Warwick basically is like, oh yeah.
You know, they kept cards on us all. Oh, there were things like, good boys talks too much.
And it's just like, look, Dionne, you are from Jersey.
Yeah. It was
tell
very
me what you really thought.
Say more.
Frank Schiffman. And you know what? Maybe this is the time for me to take it to Twitter, because we know Auntie Dionne is very active on Twitter. Maybe we need to ask her. You know what I mean? It's time to let the truth come out.
Yes.
Okay, so Ronald, we have to talk about Amateur Night. I mean, we cannot talk about the Apollo without talking about Amateur
Night. Not possible.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Apollo Amateur Night audition.
So actually, my father was in a band when he was in high school that was managed by one of the original members of the Temptations, Eddie Kendricks, the falsetto.
This was in Detroit?
Yeah. My dad grew up in Detroit, and you know, Motown was like everywhere back then. So like when he was a teenager, the band would sometimes like go on small tours. I mean, my dad was probably 15, I think, when he did this. He tells me this now and I'm like, you never would have let me do anything like this when I was 15. But whatever. And so they ended up like they went on a trip to New York. They played at the Copacabana. Pretty big venue back in the
absolutely.
Day. We're talking about like the 60s, maybe early 70s. And they auditioned at the Apollo and they did not make it to amateur night because they don't play for the most part. Now, I do know that some people, I think they do kind of pass through. I used to watch amateur night on the Apollo on TV. And sometimes I was like, now y'all know that these people were going to get booed.
They had no business being up there.
For 82 years, people have been coming to the Apollo Theater to boo the amateurs.
First, you give them the power of the boo. And everybody's at some time in their life wants to boo someone, you know.
Boo! Get off! Boom! Sing your best once you open your mouth, because you don't have no second chance.
So I've been to amateur night, and the audience were the people that you needed to be the most afraid of.
Yes.
Because basically, it's sanctioned there to boo. Like, people make jokes a lot of the time about like old vaudeville stuff, like being able to throw tomatoes mm-hmm. on the stage or whatever at people. No, literally, I think that the booing at the Apollo is a lot more hurtful. People will stand up. Yeah. They will gesture. They will yell at you. They will start pointing off stage and be like, get off, get off, get off.
Yeah.
If you are not up to snuff, you have to get off the stage. I like the fact that the Apollo as an institution relies on the connoisseurship of the audience.
Yes.
The audience at the Apollo, they know what's funny. They know who can sing. They know what good music sounds mm-hmm. like. And it's like so fun to be a part of that audience. But the other thing too is that like you have to give the performers some credit because they know. They know.
Yeah.
When they get on that stage, there is a chance that they could be booed off within an inch of their
life. Yeah. Yeah.
All this talk about amateur night makes me wonder. I know my answer. And I'll tell you, but not before you tell me, if you were to perform on Amateur Night at the Apollo, what are you doing for your talent?
There was a church talent show that I did one time in which they're like, you need to show a talent. And my talent was solving a Rubik's Cube.
Oh.
And I gotta be honest with you, I know that sounds crazy, but it's the one thing that if they see that it's being solved in front of you, then it's hard to boo that.
Ronald.
It's hard to boo if you're actually doing it. Now, if I took too long, if I take longer than like 7 minutes, like if it's up there, it's like, man, this guy ain't gonna ever finish this. I can see myself getting booed, but that's what I would do. It's safe.
Wait, did you finish it at the church talent show?
Yes. I mean, you can finish it right now.
How did you explain that to your elders? Like, they're like, Ronald, what you want to do at the church? At the church talent show, you like Rubik's Cube.
Yeah. So that's the thing. I was a grown man when I did this. I was in my like late 20s. I was one of the leads of Sunday school. So we had to do stuff to encourage the kids to do it.
Oh, that's so nice.
And while I'm playing it, I stressed out and I had to do one move several times. And the crowd started being nervous for me.
Oh,
and so
the
band started playing this song called The Blood Still Works. They started playing that. And I'm like, I'm getting more nervous, but eventually I finished it and it all worked out. But wait, enough about me. Tell me your talent. I want to know your talent.
I would sing. That's what I would do. I would sing.
Okay.
I am self-preserving, so I would never put myself on amateur night at the Apollo.
Me either.
I'm trying to think of what I would sing though. Honestly, probably a Luther song. Not that I really think about it.
Now I'm wanting to hear you sing. Like, I think the listeners... Yeah, the listeners deserve a taste. I don't know.
You know what? Let's move on.
Oh, man, we were so close. We were so close.
You know, we have a great interview coming up with Roger Ross Williams and Camila Forbes. Let's get into that, okay?
All right, Brittany. Well, if you're not going to sing, I am in the mood for some singing. I need some singing. So let's play some Lettucey. Let's play her singing Robert Glasper's song, Don't Turn Back Now. And that's in the closing credits of the documentary.
The music is a revelation, the sound of every generation, powerful enough to free us from chains. And after everything we've been through, there is nothing that we can do.
Up next is our interview with Roger Ross Williams and Camila Forbes.
We'll
Williams is the director of the Apollo documentary. He has directed and produced multiple film and television projects over the last two decades, including the film Music by Prudence, which won an Academy Award back in 2010.
And Forbes is seen in the film as both the Apollo Theater's creative head and the director of the stage adaptation of Ta-Nehisi Coates' Between the World and Me, which premiered at the Apollo back in 2018. Forbes also directed the film adaptation of Between the World and Me, which is available to stream right now on HBO Max.
So, Roger, Camila, before we get into the Apollo doc, I want to go back a little bit. Y'all are both creatives who've been making work for decades. And in recent years, you guys have become, like, I think what they're calling it is booked and busy. And you got a full slate of projects. You're directing and producing. What is it like to have to go from grinding and having to fight to get your projects made to having a lot more opportunities to make work, even having people come to you to have work made?
Well, you know what's interesting? I think it was always making work and always grinding. It's just now there's more resources. Now people are actually paying me. What's driving you is the passion. What's driving you is the work. What's driving you is that urgency to tell this story at this time, whether hell or high water. And, you know, the beauty is if you can do that and get paid while you're doing it, that's the gold.
Yeah.
Well said. For me, it was about not forgetting where I came from. It was about not forgetting the struggles that I went through and to open the doors for others. And about 6 years ago, I was elected to be the governor of the documentary branch of the Academy of Motion Pictures, Arts, and Sciences. And the board of governors runs the Academy and runs the Oscars. And I walked into that room, and there was Steven Spielberg, the governor of the director's branch, and Tom Hanks, the governor of the acting branch, and the most powerful people, all white men in the industry. And I was only the second black person elected to the board of governors after the great Sherrill Boone Isaacs. But I remember thinking a lot of them didn't see me, but I could, you know, sort of cower in the corner, or I could rise to the occasion and kick open the door for everyone else. And that was about the work that I set out to do in the doc branch, but it's also the work that I set out to do setting up my production company, One Story Up. And what I get to do is bring in a whole cadre of young black creators who haven't had the opportunity to, you know, to tell their stories.
Mm. I love the way you put that.
Roger, how did you first get involved with this project?
There were lots of people who had attempted to make a documentary about the Apollo. There never has been one, believe it or not. I couldn't believe that when they told me that. I got a call from actually Lee Daniels' company. So they asked me if I was interested. You know, I had great partners in White Horse Pictures who were already on the project and developing it. And then I bought on legendary Lisa Cortez, my producer, who lives in Harlem, worked in the music industry, really, you know, was a perfect person to take the journey with me. And we just went for it. Mm-hmm. Lisa literally went to Jerry Kupfer, who was the producer of Amateur Night at the Apollo, and went through his basement, dug, and bought back, you know, moldy old 3/4-inch tapes of Amateur Night at the Apollo. And we transferred that. And like, wow. You know, that, it was like a treasure hunt. She went to people's apartments and to houses and dug through stuff.
So, Camila, why was it important for the Apollo Theater to authorize the making of this documentary? And what were you as an organization hoping to accomplish?
What was really important, number one, is telling our story. There had never been a major singular piece on film told of the Apollo. And to imagine that story not being told, that history not being told, but more importantly, being told by Black storytellers. The time was now. The time was right, right? As us as an institution, how do we tell our history in order to tell where we're forging forward? I remember my first day, which was now almost 6 years ago, at the Apollo. That actually was at the first day I learned where the bathrooms were. And then they said, you're going to sit and meet with this filmmaker, Roger Ross Williams.
That's right. Right? That's right. I was there on your first day. We went to lunch. We go to lunch at Red Rooster.
We went to Red Rooster.
On your first day.
And you were like, tell me about the Apollo. And I was like, you tell me about the Apollo. I just got here. But I mean, it was really exciting because I was such a fan of Rogers and knew and respected him so much as a filmmaker, as an artist, and as a storyteller. I knew from then, like, oh no, this has got to be done. This has got to be made.
So you start the film with the theatrical adaptation of Between the World and Me, and that's kind of the through line that you use that bridges Apollo's past and present. When did you know that that would be how you would frame the story?
Do you remember, Cam, the moment?
Yes, it was the interview. You were interviewing me for the Apollo documentary, and you were like, what's next? And I was like, oh, we're doing this. Oh, yeah, and we're going to develop, you know, this thing. And I remember you paused, and you were like, wait, what? And I was like, yeah, we're going to do this thing and we're going to do it into theater. And now I know you well enough, Roger, to know when that twinkle in your eye happens, what's happening behind it.
Oh, that's right. You know, I was far along in the process, but I was grappling for what is that thing? How am I going to connect it to the present? How am I going to engage new audiences? You know, what you guys are constantly doing as an institution. So I really didn't want this to be a history lesson. I wanted it to have a contemporary hook. And, you know, it was really important that the film, it's not just about the Apollo, it's about what's happening in Harlem and what's happening in the world around it, which is reflected on that stage. So I kept racking my brain trying to think, what is a way we can, like, bring new audiences to the Apollo and connect this story to young people. I was like, that's a perfect thing to document that process, because that is about creating a new work on the stage. It's about the dire state of Black bodies in America today. And it works on so many levels. For me, it was like, that was it. No brainer as soon as she said that.
Mm. Now, Camila, you know, you're both a talking head and a character in the documentary. What was that like for you, kind of playing both roles as the expert, but also the subject?
I knew there was a twinkle in Roger's eye when he said, oh, wait a second. Then I kept thinking, oh, man, he's about to bring cameras in. I don't know what I'm doing with this play. Oh, no, they're about to follow me around. I'm about to be exposed as a fraud. This is crazy.
Oh, you know what you're doing.
Not a fraud.
But I mean, I was producing the moment in my head about what was going to be happening on the other side and becoming very self-conscious about it. In one respect, that was circling through my mind. But on the other side, I kept thinking, but damn, it's the right choice. I get it.
I always say this. I learned so much from watching Cam direct, because, you know, she's mic'd. And when she's talking to the actors and the way she talks to them and the direction she's giving them, I was like, okay, that's my film school. I'm gonna go back and listen, re-listen. When I was like prepping for my film, I'm gonna re-listen to those directions and learn that language.
When you're at that point of innocence in your life, mm-hmm. and when things are normalized in your world, how do you register fear?
I mean, as a Black man, you're born into this world with PTSD. I mean, the first time a cop put a gun in my face, I was 9 years old. And I wasn't like Shaquille O'Neal size. I was an average 9-year-old, but that was PTSD.
The discussions they had around the table about the material they were covering and their emotional reaction to that material, that was so powerful. And I was like, oh, wow, that's how it works. And in a documentary, I wouldn't put a bunch of people in a room artificially and say, discuss what's going on in the world. Mm-hmm. That just naturally happened in the creative process of what she was doing. And it was perfect.
One of the things that was interesting to us about watching the documentary is seeing all these comment cards that, you know, Frank Schiffman had. How do you kind of reconcile that part of the Apollo's history while also holding this really revered spot for the audience as tastemakers?
I always say It is not the building or the ownership that made the Apollo. It's the people that made the Apollo. This is a theater of the community, a theater made by the community. The reason why the magic is so special, because we as Black people got to be who we are in all of our glory and majesty. And that's our culture, right? Our culture is participatory. Our culture is all about exchange. And we got to be all those sides of ourselves. And regardless of other Eurocentric performing arts spaces in which we had to conform to their rules and or mores of how to be and how to express and how to imbibe culture. So that's one piece I always remember historically. That's the real fact and made the magic of the Apollo, not the ownership. Where we are now, you know, in 1991, we became a nonprofit institution, you know, governed by a board of directors that you saw in the documentary that is primarily African-American. Our leadership is African-American, quite frankly, African-American women. And we are primarily African-American staff. As a nonprofit performing arts center, one of the largest Black performing arts centers in the country and singular Black performing arts center in the country, you know, it is a special place that we now are saying that we have to hold our culture sacred. And that shows up in the way in which we take care of artists, the way in which we present artists, the way in which we frame artists to the world. So I think that's really sort of the reconciliation between now and then, and how we, you know, kind of really move the institution now.
Mm-hmm. You know, the Schiffman cards, part of them are in the Museum of African American History and Culture. The Schiffman, his relatives contacted me and they said, we have other books and other stuff that, you know, no one has ever seen. And sitting down and talking to Bobby, one of the things I realized is that, you know, they were just businessmen, you know. He's like, his father was a businessman. Bobby was actually into the music, but his father was really a businessman and saw an opportunity for me and for us. It was a record of our history. So, you know, that's how I sort of separated that in our head. He really thought of the idea that to turn this burlesque house into a Black theater, and it was way ahead of its time. You know? So he was a brilliant businessman. He saw an opportunity and he took it. And it's great that he did, because the Schiffmans, they couldn't control what happened on that stage. And despite them being the owners, it was incredible magic, incredible discovery, incredible resilience that happened on that stage. And that's where we broadcast the story of who we are in America and lifted ourselves up out of oppression. So much that the Apollo represents is about the artists that played there, not the businessmen that own it or ran it.
Camila, what do you think a documentary can achieve that a fictional story can't?
You know, something interesting about documentaries is that it puts you right in the center of the reality of the world that you are forced to look at and not look away. It forces you not to divorce yourself to that person over there during that time, way back when, et cetera. No, this is real life that actually happened to real people. What a doc is able to do is to force you into action, you know, force individuals into action to take action and move forward. And that's what I think, you know, good filmmaking should do.
Roger, I understand that you're in post on your first narrative feature, Cassandro. And you've said that making this feature reminded you why you're never going to stop making documentaries. Can you articulate what it is that you love so much about making documentaries?
There's such power in watching something unfold before your eyes, something that you don't have control over. You know, it was great making Cassandra. It was exciting, and you get to build and create these worlds and put words in people's mouth and they say them, but it also takes away a little bit of the magic. I don't always want to put words in people's mouth. I want to hear what people have to say. I want to amplify their experiences and go to places that, you know, I'm surprised by. And I think only in documentary can you do that.
It's like an element of surprise, the thing that you can't plan.
No matter how much you plan, it's going to take you in another direction in the documentary. Mm-hmm. People are unpredictable and situations are unpredictable. And, you know, there's that, what's that saying, you know, you can't make this stuff up. You know, there's always that element in documentary that, you know, you can make up. And if you make it up, if you try to write it into a screenplay, people wouldn't believe it, you know, because real life is unpredictable and beautiful.
So in terms of updates, the documentary first aired on HBO in November 2019, which we now know was just a precious few months before the onset of the pandemic.
Mm-hmm. But of course, the coronavirus pandemic has really devastated the live entertainment industry. And like a lot of venues, the Apollo has pivoted to digital performances. And in 2021, they hosted several virtual events, including the Versus Battle with D'Angelo versus D'Angelo. D'Angelo, apparently peerless.
Correct.
And I don't disagree.
Correct.
But they also, exactly. But they also hosted the Soul Train Awards and an Aretha Franklin tribute featuring Jennifer Hudson, which, chef's kiss.
In June 2021, they inducted the queen of R&B soul, Mary J. Blige, into their Apollo Legends Hall of Fame with a Walk of Fame plaque outside the theater.
That's my girl. That's, look, Mary J. Blige, my queen. Oh, if only I had been there.
Yes. And speaking of honors, let's also give it up for Roger Ross Williams, who won an Emmy for the Apollo in 2020.
Yes, let's give it up for Roger. He won for Outstanding Documentary or Nonfiction Special.
Mm, so well deserved. So, Brittany, let's close out the show the way we always do. What would you say is your biggest takeaway from this episode?
It's just amazing to me how especially nowadays, that like this one physical location that is just meant to entertain people has really shaped American culture for almost 100 years consistently.
Agreed.
I mean, the Apollo's touched the lives of people who haven't even been there, even though if it wasn't always owned by Black people. The power of having a Black cultural institution and how enduring those spaces really are. That's my biggest takeaway. What about you, Ronald?
It really puts in perspective what it took for Black performers to be considered legitimate artists. Mm. First, they had to go through a gauntlet of their own making before they could even be presented, you know, to the world. So once they get through the gauntlet that is the Apollo, you know, now you are really ready for prime time. So it really gave me a lot of insight into, you know, what Black performance really takes.
Well, that's a wrap on this episode and the very first season of HBO Docs Club. Ronald, can you believe it?
I actually can't, Brittany. Thanks so much to all of our listeners for tuning in.
And just to give you guys a heads up, we may drop a bonus episode or two in the feed down the line, but you won't know when it's coming. So stay subscribed and stay tuned.
That's right. Stay tuned.
Yes. And until next time, I'm Brittany Luce.
And I'm Ronald Young Jr. And this has been HBO Docs Club. HBO Docs Club is a production of HBO and Pineapple Street Studios. It's hosted by me, Ronald Young Jr.
And me, Brittany Luce. Beyondria July is our lead producer, and our associate producer is Maria Robin Somerville. Additional production support from Natalie Peart.
Darby Maloney is our editor. Hannes Brown is our engineer and composer. John Asante is our senior managing producer.
And our executive producers are Barry Finkel, Jenna Weiss-Berman, and Max Linsky. You really love these Rubik's Cubes.
It's a party trick. Keep one in your pocket, Brittany.
You can't keep a Rubik's Cube in your pocket.
No, right? You really can't.
Unless, I don't know, maybe you're wearing JNCOs.
No, I meant your proverbial pocket.